This week on Family Anatomy, anatomy of three things.
The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And we are talking about three recent studies that we read about that we thought were interesting that have to do with mental health or parenting or relationships, right?
That's right.
That's usually right. What we do at the end of the month.
Yes, we do the anatomy of three things.
Wow, and it's the end of February already. Oh, spring is just around the corner.
Yes, it is, like, except it was a kind of a blizzard yesterday.
It's hard to imagine. Okay, yes. Yeah, it's freezing cold right now. We had to turn the furnace down because it was we could hear the furnace on the microphones. But we brought three stories today, so one of the ones I was going to talk about was about what happens to not the victim of bullying or the bully themselves, but what is the impact of witnessing bullying on kids? And you actually read two things. You're bringing two things to the table today. What's going on?
Of course, I'm two-thirds of the talent you on the show, so makes sense.
I find that hard to believe. This may be the first time you've brought two stories. Okay, that's good.
Sure. Now,
and you read them.
And of course, I scanned them.
Skim them at least. You've got the gist. What more do you need?
I got the big gist.
What are your stories about today?
What's the big point, as my son would say?
The major. What's the big point?
The big point?
What's the big point of talking about this stuff?
What's the big idea and what's the point? He mixes those together.
Uh-huh.
What is the big point?
Well, that's important. What is the big point of your first story you were going to talk about?
There's a study that is going to be, we've sort of talked about this in the past a little bit, but we've got some different sort of research implications here. Something about life satisfaction, how that's related to having kids.
Okay, how having kids affects your satisfaction with your life, and what about your second one?
And the second one, which is our third story of our top three things.
Third story of the top three.
We're going to be talking about how the language that spouses use with one another can say a lot about how they get along.
Okay, so we've got witnessing bullying, we've got the life satisfaction that changes when you have kids, and the language that you talk with your spouse. That's interesting. Okay, what's the number one? Which do you want to talk about first?
Let's start with yours.
Start with mine, because it's the best. Obviously.
Because it's at the top of my list, and it's easier for me to read up.
The mental health implications of witness status from School Psychology Quarterly, a recent issue from 2009.
And this is an article by Joan Rivers and her colleagues.
Ian Rivers,
Ian,
in fact.
Sorry, Ian.
I don't know if he's
related
any relation.
To Joan.
Probably.
Yeah.
There must be a distant relative. They both have the same last name, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the research on bullying concerns either the bully or the victim, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at the rules that are being put in place around bullying, and especially you hear a lot about the zero tolerance and those kinds of things, it's really focused on punishing the perpetrator more than anything else.
Right. And the research, it makes sense that, you know, you look at the research first, you're going to be looking at what happens to victims. Right.
Right. And in fact, we talked ages and ages ago about that guy who thought that anti-bullying programs turn kids into oversensitive wimps because they're reacting to being called names, and they're just overreacting to things. And so his point, and I can't think of his name right now, but it's on our website. I'll have to look for a link to that. But his point was that it's important to work with the victims of bullying because they need to learn how to get out of that victim role too. It's not just about punishing the bully.
Right. So he was talking about what to do, but what we know from research is that victims have higher rates of depression, anxiety, physical complaints, lower academic achievement, self-esteem and social problems, and substance abuse problems as well. And then the perpetrators or the bullies tend to have lower levels of school engagement.
Mm-hmm.
They have higher rates of delinquency outside of school, and again, more substance abuse. So we know that about them, and they're the main actors in these experiences. But now we're really starting to look at the effects on witnesses or bystanders.
The bystanders, right? So Ian Rivers and his colleagues surveyed. It was pretty big studies. They surveyed over 2,000 students between the ages of 12 and 16. So what would that be? About between grade 6 and grade 10, right?
And this is in the UK?
In the UK, they looked at youth from various schools, and they investigated bullying, mental health, and substance use. And they found that in their study, 20% of students were perpetrators of bullying. 20% of the students in their study were bullies. 34% were victims of bullying, and 63% were witnesses to bullying. 63%, two-thirds of the students in their study, and it was a pretty big study, and it happened in multiple schools, two-thirds of them were witnesses. So this is a big group. It's much bigger even than the bullies and the victims, right? I guess if you combine bullies and victims, maybe it's about the same as that, right?
I mean, the majority of kids in a school population are either going to be involved in a primary way, that means they're the bully or the victim, or in a secondary way as a witness. That's the majority of the kids at the school.
Right. And observing bullying had an impact on mental health. So students who weren't even participants, students who had observed bullying were having more mental health difficulties, and that occurred even when the witnesses weren't ever bullied themselves. So right, people who had never been victims.
And the mental health risks that were higher for witnesses were things like higher anxiety, paranoid thinking, and even substance abuse.
Yeah, interpersonal sensitivity. And in fact, their reactions, those mental health consequences, I guess you could say, of being a witness to bullying, those were over and above the kinds of things that were happening for being a bully or being a victim. So somebody who is both a bully and was witnessing other people bullying, that had a greater impact on them when you put both of those together than just bullying by itself.
Right. I mean, when it's not the case that they're also a bully and they're witnesses, I mean, there's lots of reasons that this can be affecting them. They could be fearing that they may be next.
It might happen to them, yeah.
They might be feeling guilty because there's probably quite a conflict there. Should I intervene? It's the right thing to do. What if something happens to me? It's a difficult, conflictual situation.
They talk in the study about the role of being an outsider versus being a defender, for example, and how you have kind of a different status as a defender of a victim than you do if you're just on the outside.
Yeah, and I think it's a part of what they end up saying is that they have recommendations for school psychologists in particular because, you know, they're one of the adults that are around. But I think even in school boards across the country, they're starting to realize that witnesses, because now we're thinking witnesses are other kids, right?
Yeah.
So that's the image that we have in our minds. But really, witnesses can be teachers. They could be psychologists that are walking around the school. They mm-hmm. could be principals, vice principals, parents that happen to be coming by. And there's a lot of programs starting to get instituted where they're requiring people who work at the school, anyone who works at the school, to report anytime they see an incident of bullying.
So they're
basically encouraging people to stop being witnesses alone and start being defenders in one way or another.
Right. It's sort of a whole school intervention where you're trying to reduce a culture of bullying. You don't want your school to be one that accepts that kind of behavior, right?
And really, when there's witnesses that don't do anything, there can be a tacit sort of implication there that it's acceptable. And that's what they want to try and get away from.
Right. So let's talk about our second story. What have you got?
Sure. Now, if you start looking at the research around life satisfaction and having kids.
Ah, life satisfaction. How I dream of life satisfaction. How I would like to be satisfied.
I'm so happy that you're here to segue me nice and easily into this new topic.
You like
topic.
That? How I like interrupt that. You with the segue?
It's because, you know, if you look up, are you going to be feeling more satisfied with your life after having kids? A lot of the research is going to say either no happier than before or actually less satisfied with your life than you were.
Right. I remember writing about a book. Oh, and now I can't think of the book, the name of the book, by that French author who was writing the case against having kids. Remember
right,
that? That was on the website.
That's right. That's
and that was
right.
pretty controversial even in our own little social circle.
Well, sure. It's very controversial. Yeah. But really what that author was saying was what a lot of research, if you look at it overall, what it says is it's either, like again, it's either not going to make an impact in terms of your life satisfaction having kids, or it's going to make things worse in terms
right.
of life satisfaction. That's what you get.
And researchers have talked about the idea that when you have kids, there are a number of small rewards, but those are associated with a great deal of hassle.
That's right.
So your child's first word, that's a big deal, but how many diaper changes and sleepless nights do you have to endure to get to those, that first word or the first smile or things like that?
Well, I hope I don't have to count that because it'll take the rest of the show.
Let's not try and weigh out the the positives. You know
how
what?
How many diapers? You probably, see, I'm still in that stage, so, you know.
But part of the difference there, I think, is that if you look at your day-to-day, how happy are you feeling right now versus your overall satisfaction with your life? I mean, for me, kids have been a big deal.
Okay.
I'm far more satisfied now with kids than without.
Yes, but this is what's interesting. Now, so this is a recent study by Louis Angeles.
Okay. And it is recent, right? It's the December issue, I think, of... Oh, let me find it here.
Journal of Happiness Studies.
Journal of Happiness Studies.
That's right. Journal of Happiness Studies. Now, what they did, they analyzed data from the British Household Panel Study. So this is an interview of household members over 16 years of age. This is, again, in Britain.
And, it's a pretty broad survey, right?
It's a very broad survey, yeah. And so what they did was they found that if you just look at the broad data, that, yeah, that original conclusion that I've already mentioned is what you get, that it's, you know, probably shouldn't have kids at the very least. It's not going to do anything good for you, and it could
in terms of your life satisfaction,
right?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stress and things associated with having kids too.
Here's the thing that these previous researchers did not do: they didn't parcel out the data. So what Louis Angeles did is he looked at the data more closely. What he found is this: if you're separated, living as a couple, or never married and in a single person, then when you have children, your life satisfaction does in fact decrease. However, if you're a person who is married and has children, your life satisfaction actually increases.
And in fact, it increases more with each child that you have.
Which is really something, because right. it's usually you think about it the opposite way. It's more stress, more burden, and so on. But, you know, think about it. If you're there's a chance that people will come away from this thinking that there's a prejudice towards marriage and that people who are single with children, you know, do you know what I mean? It's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Or if they're separated with children, it's not a good thing. It's not, that's not what this study is meant to be saying.
Right.
It's just a reality that if two people are sharing the responsibility, the work that's involved, it's going to be a lot less stress.
I think that's
a single person.
And we talked about that when we talked about, we did an episode, right, on cohabiting, on living together versus getting married.
Right. And so that's what you have. Because it also has a couple living together, and never married is also amongst the group that is going to be less satisfied. Now, why is that? The sense you get is, again, it has to do with the degree to which they're seeing themselves as a partnership and a unit that works together to deal with the kinds of challenges that kids bring along.
Right. And it may be that married couples are more likely to plan to have a child than couples who are living together. I'm not sure if that's the case, but it's certainly one of the things they mentioned here as a possible explanation. When we were talking about cohabitation, that was one of the things that we found, was that unmarried people who are living together with kids, it's not just life satisfaction, their satisfaction with their relationship goes down.
Right.
They're more reactive to stress and their relationship is more stressful for them as well. So that's definitely a factor to think about. Those early years of having a new baby are very stressful. And if you're in a relationship, or if you're not in a relationship where you have somebody who's supporting you, that can be really, it's that much more stressful, I would say.
Absolutely. And, you know, so you also have that sense that, you know, maybe the fact is that the reason that things are better in terms of life satisfaction for married people is that they've thought longer about their relationship and the commitment they're making to it, and that they had kids at a more appropriate time that of their choosing. That's another possibility there.
Right, because they did say even older married couples were more satisfied as well with their lives when they had kids, sure.
That's right.
That's definitely a possible factor there. There may also be this idea that if you're in a situation where you're living with someone to try it out, that trial marriage situation that sometimes we get into, that child might feel like the thing that's the barrier to your escape. If you get into a situation where you think, well, I have an out, I'm not married, I can, if things go bad, well, that's okay. I can leave. But once you have a child, that becomes a very different situation.
It becomes a different situation. And again, I think it's sort of reflecting the degree to which you're working as a team, meaning, you know, the two partners in the relationship to raise these kids and your commitment to raising them. And I think the more focused and the more teamwork that there is there, the more that the stressful situations that come up, you're able to deal with them better and not have it affect you personally as much.
It would be interesting to see, because in the relationship on marital satisfaction or relationship satisfaction, in the paper that when we were looking at that, they found that couples who were living together but who planned to get married, so couples who were engaged and they planned to be married within a year or two, and they lived together, their satisfaction with their relationship was about the same as couples who were married and living together. So I wonder, couples who are engaged and have a child at home, I wonder if that would make a difference.
That's another thing. And I think probably they didn't have that kind of statistic there, but that would make sense.
Well, they did find, though, that couples who had a child from a previous relationship, that had a different kind of an impact on their relationship satisfaction as well. So it's really complicated. When you start talking about happiness and satisfaction, my goodness, you think about your day-to-day versus your long-term satisfaction. You know, I feel satisfied for sure, but day-to-day it can be pretty busy and stressful when you're bringing kids back and forth to different extracurricular events, or if they're up all night with the flu, or, you know, those are situations that aren't necessarily fun that you might not have to deal with if you weren't a parent, but I wouldn't give it up for the world.
Oh.
Let's talk about... No, I would not.
No, I would
not. If you are listening, Mike, children, I would not change my mind. So let's talk about your final study. I like the title of it already. We Can Work It Out.
This is an article by George Harrison.
And Paul McCartney.
Yep. Who are researchers in the UK.
Right.
Well, this is a study by Benjamin
Cider. Okay. I would say Cider.
Colleagues, Benjamin Cider.
Hirschberger is an easier name. Hirschberger is an easier name to say. That's the second author.
This is in the journal Psychology and Aging.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rest of the title there is Age Differences in Relational Pronouns, Physiology and Behavior in Marital Conflict. What does that mean?
Well, the first part of the title I like. The second half, I can take it or leave it.
Yes. We should have just stuck with the first part. Yes. Anyway, the point is, I guess, that what they did is they interviewed middle-aged and older-age couples in 50-minute interviews, and they had them in a conflictual conversation, kind of a scenario. And then they took the transcripts and they analyzed how often they said they had we pronouns in those conversations versus you and I pronouns.
Okay.
Okay. And while they were having those conversations, they also were monitoring their physiological responses, that they had them hooked up.
Mm.
And also some emotional responses. And so they were analyzing to see if there was a correlation between the kind of physiological and emotional responses they were exhibiting during the conversation and some of these pronouns, we pronouns versus you and I pronouns.
Okay.
Right? And so I guess the idea is there that we is sort of symbolically reflecting something in that relationship, that they're more interdependent, they're more united, their identities are more interdependent, I guess, on each other. And you and I sort of reflects more of an independent identity that they understand each other with inside that relationship.
It's a teamwork idea versus the independent thing.
Tying it back into the last study. Very good.
See how
Dr.
I did that?
Dr. McDonald.
Yes.
You're paying attention, which is, you know, that's another...
If only I could have interrupted you with a segue to lead into this, it would have been perfect.
Excellent. Well, we could do that later.
My plan would be complete.
Editing.
Yes.
All right. So what was the result? People that used we pronouns had lower cardiovascular arousal.
So they were less
stressed.
Hooked
up, so they could tell this. They were less stressed.
Physically, they were less stressed.
That's right. They had more positive and fewer negative emotions they were displaying.
Mm-hmm.
And higher marital satisfaction. These are the people that used we more.
Now, which came first is the question.
So that, yeah, I mean, it's just a correlation.
Yeah.
So you don't know which came first.
It could be people who are more relaxed or more willing to work together as a team.
It could be.
And use that kind of language.
It could be.
But you know what? The language is, as someone who works with families and does family therapy, and you work even with couples, right? That kind of language sends some important subtle messages.
It does.
When people are communicating to one another.
The only piece of evidence that makes you think that it's not the other way around is that older people were more likely to use we language than the middle-aged people. So that there's a trajectory there. As you get older, you're more likely to use the we language.
You see yourself more the longer you've been in a relationship. You see yourself as being more interdependent, perhaps.
That's what they're suggesting.
It's funny, though, when we're doing, and you know, as a couples therapist, when you're doing some communication exercises with people who are in a high conflict relationship, one of the things that you teach people in your office to do is to use I language, right? Is to say, this is how I feel, rather than saying, you make me do this, and you make me so angry, is to take ownership of their feelings and use I language. And maybe we should be encouraging the use of we as well.
We language, yeah. Now, I guess there's a difference in therapy because there's a really intense conflictual situation.
And there's
there.
A particular goal, right, that you're
goal.
Trying to
sure,
reach. Yeah,
sure.
It's a bit different.
And you, of course, is always sounds more like it's going to be judgmental or expressing some sort of frustration with the other person.
French therapists probably use we language all the time.
They probably do.
We. Sorry, I interrupted you again. But yeah, see, when you're in therapy, you're working towards a particular thing because you want to reduce blame and those. You want to get to the point where the couple can work together again.
Right. Now, here's the other thing, you know, because we're reducing this. I language in the therapy context is, when you do that, I feel this way. It's not... I always do everything around here. I'm the one that does that. You're the one that never, you know, like that.
It's expressing how you feel in a way that's
in a different context.
It's meant to be not blaming. It's meant to try and express how you're feeling, and then the other person tries to say back, you know, well, what I'm hearing is that this is how you feel. Did I understand you correctly?
By the way,
kind of idea.
I'm carrying this show. And you, let's see, this is not what you want to do.
No.
I think we are ready to wrap this up.
All right. Why don't we get to our website of the week?
Let's do it. And our website of the week this week is scienceofloneliness.com. It's a website that's headed by John Cacioppo and William Patrick. And we spoke about this last month on the show.
Exactly a month ago when we did Top Anatomy of Three Things. We talked about how loneliness spreads in a community, and that was a study by Dr. Cacioppo. Did I do it right?
That's good. You got
Dr. Cacioppo and his colleagues. And here is here's the website about, well, it concerns their book, Dr. Cacioppo and William Patrick, their book about loneliness. And what I really love the logo. I often talk about the logo of these sites that we pick for the website of the week. They spelled out loneliness all lowercase, and the little dot over the I is far away from the word. It's isolated from the rest. And so, but this is a site that it's not just news stories about their book or anything like that. It really is about the study of loneliness and social isolation and its impact, and how people who are socially isolated can become connected again.
That's right. And they've got a cover story in New York Magazine that looks kind of interesting. And there's also a blog about loneliness. And the latest one we're seeing here, Easing Your Way Out of Chronic Loneliness. And there's a bunch of tips for extending yourself, having an action plan, being selective in the things that you do, and expecting the best out of the interactions you have.
Now, you might find a number of sites that give you ideas about reducing isolation and things like that. But what's great about this one is that you know it's based in, there's some research behind it. This is a guy who is studying the science of loneliness. He's not just, you know, he's not somebody who's just coming up with these ideas off the top of his head. He's an expert in this field. And so he's definitely got some good practical ideas. There's even an area on the blog where, like a discussion forum, where people can kind of get together and talk about these ideas that Dr. Cacioppo is promoting.
That's right.
And we shouldn't leave out his colleague.
No.
Is it Dr. Patrick? William Patrick, but we're getting hung up on the name because it's Italian and you were so careful about pronouncing it last time is the issue. But yeah, there's a discussion forum where people can get together and talk about the research findings and maybe even their experiences. And it's just about getting connected again. And I just think it's so great to have information like this that's research-based.
That's right. And really, you know, it's about loneliness, but the subheading, it almost says more. You know, it's the need for social connection and human nature. So it's actually a positive site in a lot of ways.
It certainly is. And that's our website of the week, scienceofloneliness.com.
And that's it for us. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com. And as always, Dr. Brian McDonald has an announcement.
I do. We've been talking all this month about how close we're getting to episode 100, and we're very excited about it. As usual, we want to thank everybody who's been promoting what we do, who's sharing the information that we share, who's linking back to us, who's sharing our stories on Twitter and Facebook and all of those places. We're at the end of the month again. So podcastalley.com is resetting their votes. So we've appreciated the votes that people have sent us so far, but we're going to be back down to zero as of March the 1st. So if you enjoy the show, if you want to help promote what we do, what you can do is go to podcastalley.com. You can either look under the kids and family section, or you can search in the search box for Family Anatomy. You can find us there, throw us a vote that promotes our show. People find it that way. for sure. And you can help keep us the number one kids and family podcast over at Podcast Alley. So as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do.
FamilyAnatomy.com.